For those of you who have never heard of Lubbock, Texas, that's where Buddy Holly's from. Well, he was. Not from there anymore. Love Buddy Holly music. And I had never heard of Lubbock either until I moved down there. But it's part of the culture, and it really was a lot of fun. Lubbock was a wonderful, wonderful place for our family. The city is laid out. It's all flat. The panhandle of Texas is rather barren. Nowhere near as pretty and unique as this part of Washington is, but the people there are incredibly warm and friendly. All the residential areas have a park in the middle with slides and swing sets and ducks, and all the Canadian geese come down in winter with us, so it must be a pretty nice place. I mean, they chose it too. I grew up in the Northwest, as was mentioned. Spokane, we looked at it on the map, and I said, well, let's see, I have a brother in Seattle. I have a son in Seattle. I have family that spends the summers in Helena. My mom lives in Medford, Oregon. And we kind of triangulated that, and it came in pretty good right here. And we said, well, that's a good option. That'll be a nice place to be. My wife, Michelle, grew up in Albuquerque. And all of her family scattered through the region down there in the Southwest. And so while we've been in Lubbock, we've been there now 6 years, she had a chance to be close to her aunts and uncles and cousins and go back and forth. Albuquerque was about 300 miles away, and so I suppose it's like driving into Seattle with a little more. And her parents moved in right behind us. What we're trying to figure out is how to get her parents to move out right behind us. You know, they're down there where it's warm and it's nice and it's cheap. Cost of housing in Lubbock is, let's just say this, the cost of housing in Spokane is 50% higher than the cost of housing in Lubbock. It's incredibly inexpensive down there. They're on a fixed income. They're established. And there's a funny thing that happens when you get older. You tend to get rather stable. And you really, a move is a challenge that's almost insurmountable at a certain age, it seems. And so they're not sure that they're really able and mentally and emotionally to pick up. They have friends there and close association as well. So we're trying to drag them out of Texas and bring them with us. And so I solicit your prayers on our family's behalf. But we have an extended family that is precious to us. Grandma and Grandpa have raised the kids almost as much probably as we have. The children spend the night there. They set up with a trailer park, and they just set up with about three lots, and we fenced in the whole area, and the kids can dig and throw and hammer and nail. And I think it was Grandma and Grandpa that taught Megan and Derek how to use a ketchup bottle. They taught them how to go down the counter and pick the things off the counter at the buffet, and they just have made a wonderful contribution in our lives, and we'd surely like them to be able to follow and be with us. Michelle and I attended the feast here in 1985 and 1986. Anybody here on those years attending the feast? Couple? Everybody. Anybody new in this church? We lived in Boise at the time. One of the things I remember about Boise is there's no wind there in the winter, and the snow is very, very powdery dry. And many times, instead of shoveling your sidewalks, you would sweep them. I remember going out there literally with a broom and dusting off the walks. And we had a little picket fence in front of the house, and the snow would pile up on top of the pickets and would be 2, sometimes 3 inches high, stacked on a pointed picket on a fence. Now, I'm going to just assume that the snow here is just like that as well. Not so? Well, I thought that was unusual when they were there anyway. Our two children at home, Megan and Derek, they're going to be 8 and 6. Derek will be 6 this month. Megan will be 8 in April. They were glad that I made it here safely. They didn't want me to leave. Nobody wants Daddy to leave. So I said, well, look, I'm going to find us a home. I'm going to find a house, someplace we can live. And that was my bargain, kind of. I'm going to do something that you want. And so they kind of let me go. Came into Spokane and called back home to check in, tell them I'm safe. The first question out of both of their mouths was, have you found a home yet? And I thought, well, you know, how do you explain to a 6 or an 8-year-old that it takes more than 15 minutes to find a home. I'd never really focused on how much their security was tied up in our home. Now, they were both born when we lived in Omaha. They were born in a hospital across the river there, which is the Missouri River, and it's in Council Bluffs, Iowa, which is actually their place of birth. But Derek was only a couple of months old when we went to Lubbock. Megan was 2 years old. And so they have no memories other than where we have been. And we lived in one house, so that's the only house they've ever known. And so to them, that home is their refuge. It's their security. Derek likes his bed and his little buffalo head on the wall. And he likes the little tomahawk, and Megan likes her dolls and her room and the decorations, and those things are very personal to them. Our home is where they rode out their first thunderstorms. Actually, our bed is where they rode out their first thunderstorms. When Michelle and I didn't have children, we had a king-sized bed. When we got children, we had a queen-sized bed. Now, I don't know the logic of that, but it didn't work the same. And as the children grew, one of them had to sleep sideways on the end to wedge in there. And finally, Friday nights was special night where everyone was in the bed, so Daddy ended up on the couch. I stayed up to work on my sermon. The kids crawled in with Mama, and so the three of them, that was their treat. They looked forward to the Sabbath, not so much because they got to go to church, but because they got to get in bed and be in the big bed in the house. We've often wondered if maybe people years and years ago, although they surely never slept, but if they didn't have it right, when you see these pictures, everybody was there in the bed, and they just turned different ways to make it fit. Like I said, I don't know how anyone got any sleep, but I think in terms of closeness in the family, in terms of not forcing maybe the children out to be independent any sooner than necessary, it probably wasn't a bad idea. Derek asked me, actually, as I was leaving the house, why couldn't we just pick up our house and take it with us? He liked it. He liked the way it's laid out. He likes our furniture. He likes our things. And so I said, no, look, we're going to take all of these things that we identify with. They're coming with us. And we'll set you up in your own room with your own bed and your own little buffalo over the top and your tomahawk on the wall. So it'll be something that you recognize when we're there. Megan and Derek, like most children, are very affectionate. They just want to be close. They want to be secure. Time and time again, as a minister, my office is in my home. I'm working in my office. They will come in the door. They don't bother to ask. I could never seem to train them to ask. And they would just kind of force their way in under my arms and crawl up into my lap. And they wanted me to hold them and snuggle them. And you could hear them at times, you know, sigh real deep as they there was like a comfort zone that they now were in, and they really and truly loved that. So Megan and Derek think of our house as a place where Mommy and Daddy make them secure, where they crawl up into bed with Mommy or crawl up into the chair with Daddy, and it's something that they're just accustomed to, and it gives them a security that they truly enjoy. They identify that with that home, with that house. That's all they've ever, in that sense, known. Psalm 127, if I can share that with you. When Michelle and I were first married, she took a plaque, a piece of wood, and she painted our little home. We started out with a home in Pasadena, California. We were renting there. The house was 600 square feet measured outside to outside. And it was a 30 by 20 foundation on the house. And it was really a delightful place. And in that house, she put up a plaque, and she painted on the plaque the house, and she painted there herself and myself, and then she painted our dogs, and she put a couple of the chickens that we had. We had chickens in the backyard back then to kind of keep us sane. It's amazing to me, and it always has been, that in Pasadena and Altadena and some of the neighboring communities, you can actually have chickens in your yard. And when I went to Boise, Idaho, you couldn't. Now, one's in the middle of a wilderness, and one is in the middle of a big city, and it just never seemed equal to me, but that's the way it has been. Michelle put that plaque up on the wall, and we still have it on the wall in our home, and it'll be on the wall in our home here. And basically, it says just exactly as Psalm 127 says, unless the Lord builds the house, They labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It's saying it doesn't matter how careful you are, how perfect you are, how well you keep a watch for danger or trouble, unless indeed you are under God's care, you have no real guarantee. It's still going to be a matter of chance. It is vain for you to rise up early, sit up late, eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. You can do all you do in this life and be as careful as you can, but true peace and true rest and true comfort only comes from God. That's what's being addressed. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Children are portrayed as something that you can take and put in your bow and aim them toward a target. You can direct them in your life. You can send them off on a course and have an impact. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Possibly one of the only scriptures in the Bible that's not totally accurate. We burned out at 2. We love them. They love us. But I know my max. And my max was a whole lot less than a quiver. Maybe just a little tiny side packet. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. It says your own children will then grow up, and they will be safe and secure. They will be protected. They will become leaders in the community. The gate is where the leaders of the community sat, and they'll go to the gate as a leader, and they'll defend you and speak for you and protect you. And so it talks about an atmosphere, a philosophy, a way of life, that under God's care, he will direct our course. We will better be able to direct our children's course, and our children will grow up and have strength and courage and opportunity as a result of that great blessing. And so she hung that on our wall, and it really has been one of our treasured possessions ever since. On the way up here, I stopped in Anaconda, Montana, as was mentioned. We left Anaconda back in 1961. I drove through Anaconda one time late at night coming back from SEP camp, heading back to Pasadena, but except for a moment's drive through in the dark, I've never been back. Never had a chance to go back and look at the house that I lived in then, look at the city, walk around. You know, it was a remarkable thing. It was so moving to me to go back after all those years. In the middle of the city is the commons. And in the commons, in the winter, they flood it with water. And then it freezes, and then we'd ice skate. And I looked in the little shack by the edge of the commons where the kind of the raised platform is, and they board it off, and they have a heater, a stove in there so that you can melt your gloves on it. And I looked in there, and I was almost convinced it was the same heater that they had when I was a kid. I remember back then, you know, I had cheap gloves. They were plastic, and I'd put them on there to kind of warm them up, and you'd get too close, and the ends would droop. Walked out on that ice. You know, it was just, I don't know how to describe the way that is after all those years and all the memories come flooding back into your mind. You look across the street. There's the church I went to as a child where my parents would give us each a dime to put in the offering and we'd spend it in the candy store on the way down. We'd walk down to church and dime. That bought a lot of candy. You know, why should I give that to the church? There was the theater where we used to go for a nickel and watch a movie. And I remember back then they had the newsreels and the serials and things before the movie itself. And the girl that was my best friend, you could say she's my girlfriend, but come on, I was in grade school. She was a friend who was a girl. And I went up the street to where her house was to just see who was there. And I found a neighbor walking around and I said, by the way, have the West Guards lived here anytime recently? And he said, oh, they moved away about 15 years ago. And they went to Billings, I think it was, he said. And so there was no way to follow up on that. I drove over to our house on 4th Street. And again, you look at the house, and you know, I'm thinking of Megan and Derek and the way they look at our house. And then I look back at this house as a child. And I looked at that house in that sense as a refuge, as a place of security and safety. My dad finished the attic and put bedrooms up there. And then he finished the basement and put bedrooms down there. And so we scattered through the house. And as a child, I thought we lived in a mansion. That basement seemed as big as an auditorium. It's just a little tiny house on a little tiny lot. And, you know, I remembered the time when my brother, as we were out fishing in Rock Creek, and he found a garter snake and put it in his pocket, snuck it home in the back of the car, kept peeking its head out of his pocket, and he'd keep jamming it back in. We stored it in the garage. One day, Mom went out there to get in the car, and it came out to say hello. Never saw that snake again. Almost never saw daylight again either. It was not a good time. Out behind the house was a school bus yard. We'd walk through the school bus yard because right behind the school bus yard was the train yard. We'd sneak through the train yard. You'd have to kind of hop across sometimes the connections between the trains, and because right behind the train yard was the park, city park. And the city park was where we fished and rode our bikes. They had greenhouses in the city park with great big flowers, and you'd go in and see these special big blooms on the flowers. Right around the greenhouses was a circular drive. I remembered how one time, maybe this will give you an indication of what kind of boys we were. One time, my brother and I decided to play chicken. I had three brothers. Problem was, neither one of us was chicken. We had our bikes, and we started riding around this circular drive, going faster and faster, and riding right toward each other. Neither one of us would ever think of turning to the left or the right, and we just crashed head-on, just full tilt. Crashed the bikes, bent them all to pieces, laid there in a pile of rubble, and then got mad at the other one for not having chickened out when they're supposed to. It was amazing to bring that all back to mind. I guess I'm not just telling you a bunch of stories to entertain you. My point is, I went back and I looked at that house, and it brought back all the memories of all the things that happened there and the way I felt about that house, but it brought back another memory. There was Johnny Forkin. I only remember two names from grade school. Two names. My best friend, which was a girl, and my worst friend, which was the school bully. I guess he wasn't really a friend at all. He was just a bully. And his name was Johnny Forkin, and he used to pick on me. And it was only two blocks to get from our grade school to my house. But sometimes I had to race home for two blocks to get out of there so that Johnny Forkin wouldn't come up and push me around. I never really cared for that very much, but I knew if I could get to my house, I'd be safe. And so I was down the block, one block length one time, and Johnny caught up with me with a couple of his friends, started pushing me around. And I was trying to get to my house, and they started beating on me a little bit, and I remember kind of going down to my knees and covering my head, and he and his friends are kind of pounding on me. And I was just short of my house, and my brother looked out the window. My brother was older. My brother was pretty tough. Ugly, too. And he came running out, and he chased off those bullies and pounded them a little bit and chased them all away. And I went home to the safety of the house, the sanctuary that was there. I decided this time through Anaconda I'd go look up old Johnny, my friend. I'm older now. I grew up good and tall. And I thought, well, Johnny Forkin, let's just look at this phone book here. And I opened the phone book, and here's a John Forkin right there in the phone book. And I says, that's nice. Now you're ahead of me. There was an address, and so I went up the address. And on the way over, I'm thinking, well, what if Johnny comes to the door? What'll I do? First thought flashing in my mind was, well, just punch him in the nose. I thought, nah, you can't do that. I said, nah, I'm not here for that. I said, well, maybe I can take him to lunch. I said, let's see if we can't make friends. I said, I'll take him to lunch, and we'll go out and have a good time and laugh about the old days. We'll try that. Besides, he might ask me what I do, and I'd have to tell him, and then I'd be embarrassed. So I went up, and an elderly man came to the door, and I says, is Johnny Forkin here? And he says, that's me. I thought, boy, the years have sure been hard on him, haven't they? It was Johnny's dad, John Forkin. And I told him that I was, you know, a schoolmate of Johnny's, and he told me where he was and showed me pictures, and we had a nice little chat. And I thought, well, that's too bad. But it was a nice little way of closure. But again, when I thought of Johnny Forkin, I thought of my house, and I thought of trying to get away from those kids, and I thought of that house as my refuge. It's my protection. Now, sanctuary is an interesting term. What is it that the term sanctuary, how is it that that term is used today? Sanctuary is used in the sense of taking a person in to protect them. You bring them into sanctuary. Where are most of the people taken into sanctuary when you read about it? When you read about in the paper that somebody's in sanctuary, where are they? They're in a church. They're sitting somewhere in a church. It's like the little movie, The Hunchback of, I guess it's Notre Dame. And the hunchback goes into the church and has sanctuary and lives there, and he's protected from any harm or any attack. A church is considered a sanctuary because it represents the house of God. It represents the presence of God, where God dwells, and so it's considered a sanctuary. If this was a church in this land, and this was the main meeting room, we would call it the sanctuary. Because it would portray in their minds where God dwells, where He lives, where His presence is. And so that's what sanctuary really means. The tabernacle in the wilderness was called a sanctuary. The temple that was built was later called a sanctuary as well. Notice Exodus 25. The Lord spake to Moses and said, "Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. And from everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, I want you to take this offering." And he says, "I want you to give your very best." And he talks about fine skins and gold and silver and bronze and special oil and spices and special stones, precious stones. And he said in verse 8, he says, "Let them make for me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." And so a sanctuary was a place where God went and protected and guided His people. And the tabernacle and the temple and ultimately the church is a sanctuary. And that's where that term actually comes from. It says, "According to all that I show you," that is, the pattern of the tabernacle, the pattern of all its furnishings, "so you shall make it." God says, "I want you to do it just exactly the way I say, and it will be a sanctuary to you and to all of your people." Now, the tabernacle was called a sanctuary, but the actual sanctuary ultimately was the Holy of Holies itself. The Holy of Holies was the place inside the tabernacle where God's presence was placed. It was where the ark was, picturing His throne. And God placed His presence there. There's a principle in the Bible in Proverbs 25 that says, "Don't exalt yourself in the presence of the king." And again, the concept is there that if you go into the presence of a king, he is the ruler, and he is the supreme ruler, at least in that land. And if you go into his presence, that you kind of walk softly, and you speak carefully, and you watch what you do. Now, God, obviously, is a king. Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And it is his presence, God's presence in the sanctuary that we come before when we meet in church and services, when we worship on the Sabbath. And in that sense, there's an analogy, I believe, that can be drawn that when we come into the sanctuary, just like there were rules about the Holy of Holies, and Aaron could only go in there at certain times in a certain way, and he had to dress just right and cleanse himself. And then the temple had to be used in a certain way and the offerings made. In that sense, we come before God in His sanctuary. We come before God in a humble attitude and approach. It says in the Bible to come before His presence with praises and thanksgiving. We come to rejoice. We come to fellowship. We come to worship God because He is a great King. And He offers us sanctuary. He offers us refuge. He offers us protection and peace. So we take refuge in the presence of God. In the old hymnal is a song. I'm sure it's in the new hymnal, it's just that I didn't have the new one with me when I looked at this. Song 98 is, "God is our refuge." And I was looking through that. It says, "God is our refuge and our strength, and straits a present aid. Therefore, although the earth remove, we will not be afraid." No matter what happens, even if the earth around us is in turmoil, we need not be afraid because we're in God's sanctuary. "A river is whose streams make glad the city of our God, the holy place, wherein the Lord Most High has His abode." Where does God live? Where does He maintain His presence? In the sanctuary, in His people. "God in the midst of her doth dwell, and nothing shall her move. The Lord to her a helper will, and that right early prove." says you can be sure that that's what God's going to do. Psalm 46 is where that song came. Psalm 46 has three songs in the old hymnal dedicated to it, explaining it, using it in song and praise. I think there's only one other psalm in the Bible that is written about more than that particular Psalm 46. That was Psalm 119 about the law of God, at least in our old hymnal. I want to read Psalm 46 to you. It says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth be moved, though the mountains be carried to the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with swelling. Even in the midst of disaster, it says God is our help, He's our refuge, He's our present help when we're in trouble, and we're not going to be moved. We're not going to turn aside, we're not going to be shaken, because we can trust in God. There is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. It says, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord who has made desolation on the earth. He makes wars to cease. He breaks the bow. He cuts the spear in two. In other words, God has the power to intervene and be stronger and more powerful than any other force. And in verse 10 it says, be still and know that I am God. Megan and Derek sometimes get to chattering and getting to fussing and fighting and rattling around. And I'll stop and I'll say, stop! Be still! Be quiet! Settle down. God says, be still. Know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. God says, I've got all power. I've got all authority. Now just be still. I am your refuge. I am your strength. We have three songs in the old hymnal that go through and address that in principle. Brethren, we collectively are the temple of God. 1 Corinthians 3 says, don't you know that you're the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? It says, the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. We are the sanctuary. That is God's intent and purpose. We are a place of refuge, a place of rest. Matthew 11, another scripture, addresses in principle God's calling and what God's calling ultimately should be. Matthew 11, verse number 28. It says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Now, he's not saying he'll take the burden necessarily out of your hands. He's saying, I will lift the load from your mind. He may take the burden out of your hand as well, but he's addressing the burden of the mind. He says, come to me, all you who labor or are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest in your souls. Remarkable statement. That's what God ultimately intended His calling to be, a call to rest, a call to remove the burdens. You know, the Bible focuses on different things at different times. Sometimes God shows us in the Bible the trials and tests that are yet to come, those things that we must face. And yet at other times He reminds us of the confidence and the assurance that we have with our minds open to understand His purpose and His plan. Because we know of what God ultimately is going to produce and accomplish, it gives us confidence and it gives us hope. Paul even said to the slaves of his day, who were bound in physical service to their masters, even told them that you can still be a slave and be free. You may not be loose of your physical bonds, but in terms of your service to God, you can still be free. Now that is hard for me to understand totally. Because I think you'd almost have to be there and struggle through those circumstances and really cry out to God to experience it fully. But I do believe, indeed, that what he said was true. I hope never to be in such bondage where I have to find out. But we all struggle with various things. Some are in bondage to health. Some are in bondage to debt. Some are in bondage to relationships. I mean, we all struggle with different things. My cousin has a great little saying. He reminds me anytime I complain. He says, look, Mark, everybody's barnyard has a little... The word he uses is too graphic for a sermon. He says, you know what's in barnyards. He says, everybody's barnyard's got a little of that in it. He says, that's just part of the program. I remember very well where I came from before I was called into the church, and I'm reminded of it when I go back to a place like Anaconda and look at where I was as a kid and what we did. I remember what I was called out of. I remember what my mind was like and my focus and my goals and purposes were like before God opened my mind to the truth. My son Brad, I mentioned that he's in Seattle. He's 26 years old. See, I got a 26-year-old and a 6-year-old. A little gap in between. It's called the gap theory. Michelle and I have been married for 15 years. I've been in the church for 23. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to count out the numbers, does it? I know where I came from. I remember. I remember what it was like. And then I remember going to church for the very first time. I can still remember the very first sermonette that I ever heard in my life. Walking in the door to the church hall in Pasadena, sneaking past the guards. Remember years ago we used to have what somebody didn't know any better would think were guards on the doors. Waited for a big crowd of people to walk through, and I just kind of blended in with them. Went and sat in the back and felt like I was a spy from the KGB or something. I'm sitting in the back. But I tell you, there was something in that service that day that absolutely put me on fire. It was the message. It was the atmosphere. There was something, and I can say it had to have been indeed the Holy Spirit of God, because it wasn't something you could have just observed physically or naturally, because someone else could have sat in the room and maybe not noticed at all. I remember what it was like when I got out of the service, went back to college, and decided that I would have to be physically successful in this life, and that it was important, and that the way to do that was to go to college and to get good grades, and then to come out of college and make a lot of money. My brother has a Ferrari, I don't. Somehow we changed tracks along the way. I went to college that first year in Southern Oregon, and I worked hard, and I got a 3.8 average, and I was proud and pleased with that. But when it was over, in the process, God was calling me and beginning to work with my mind, and I looked at that. That's what I wanted. I wanted good grades. I wanted to be the top of the class as close as I could get. I wanted to be where I'd be selected when the time came for the job. And I looked at that, and I was pleased with what I had done. And then, basically, I had to say to myself, so what? Because it didn't mean to me what I thought it would. It didn't have the value that I thought it would. By that time, I was beginning to question, well, why am I even going to college? Am I just going so that I can have a job, so I can have some money, so that I can have a house, so that I can die and give it to my kids? You know, why? And God was, again, working with my mind, and I began to wonder, well, what is the purpose of this life? There's got to be something more important. There's got to be a reason why we produce. A good reason. Not just for gain. And so... I finished that year and I began to question those things. And I remember as I went into church that first time. And I remember beginning to see as I studied literature and began to listen to the radio programs back then. And I began to see indeed that there was something that was more important than anything else that I had ever known. There was a value, there was a purpose. You know, the church became my spiritual home. I am, as of today, a member of this congregation. I am a member of this congregation just like you are members of this congregation. I have specific responsibilities, but this is my home too. My home behind me is gone. The house will be sold, the goods will be packed, and I no longer pastor those congregations. That is no longer my home. My home is here. And my home is here with you. My home is not the corporation. It is the church. It is the house of God. It is the church of God. The church is where I go to lay down and to rest. It's where I go to be nourished and sustained. I asked the congregation on a number of occasions there in Lubbock, I said, please, Consider this. When you walk in the door to services, if you are only coming here to be inspired, then you haven't done your job. I said, you ought to walk, you ought to at least strive to walk in the door inspired, so that indeed you're here to make a contribution. And I asked that of them on a number of occasions. And I love those people. They were my friends. They were the people that I socially mixed and fellowshipped and traveled with. The teenagers, when we went on activities, were teenagers that I had a personal relationship with, even some of those teenagers that grew up and no longer attended. Still, one of the young men that was no longer attending church was still going skiing with me when I was leaving until the transfer was announced and I had to cancel the trip. But he had actually become, in that sense, a friend. A few weeks ago, interesting thing happened in the Roswell, New Mexico congregation, which was on the circuit there. In one service, we had members of four different churches of God assembled peacefully together to worship on the Sabbath. Now, that's kind of a remarkable thing. At least I thought it was. We had United Church of God. We had one member from Global. We had one member from Church of God International. And we had either three or four, I forget what the count was, from the Church of God Seventh Day. All sitting together in one service. It wasn't an ecumenical service. It was a service of the United Church of God, of which I pastored, but it was a sanctuary for all of God's people. And it was a remarkable thing, I believe, that took place. Now, we've had commonly different measures of different groups, but this was the first time that many had all been in one place at one time. Church of God Seventh Day had a church in Roswell that dwindled over the years. And they got down to where there was just a handful of their members, and yet they had this small hall, very nice little hall. And then the pastor moved away, and the three or four or five people that were left no longer had a pastor. One of our members had maintained very friendly and warm relationships with them over the years, lived in the town, in the community. And one of the members of the Church of God Seventh Day says, well, why don't you come over and use our hall? And I suppose some of our people will come and attend now with you. Now, they're not with United Church of God. They're with Church of God Seventh Day. But they rented us their hall. We moved in, and they sat down in the back row of services, and they've been there ever since. And it's a wonderful relationship, and it's a great blessing, because we meet together, we maintain our identity, we love and respect each other, and we fellowship and worship God together on the Sabbath. And you know a funny thing? I've never had to change one thing I've ever said in a sermon to accommodate the fact that we had churches of God in the midst. I never had to change anything at all, and it worked out very, very well. On my way up here, I made this it was only a two-day trip, seems to me like a lifetime. I couldn't get away, I just couldn't leave. I had things to finish up and family matters and things in the house, and finally, I think it was Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, I left. I stopped by Amarillo, got the last milkshake from Brahms that I'll probably have in this life. Best ice cream. Anybody ever had a milkshake from Brahms? Sorry, I'll pray for you. Best ice cream in probably the world. And it's not from Texas, from Oklahoma. But I stopped by to see an old friend. He was in Wyoming. Hadn't seen him in 21, 22 years. When I was in junior high, we had the same table in wood shop. I still have some of my old clunky bowls that I made somewhere in storage. We were friends in high school together. We went both into service, both went to Vietnam, served over in Vietnam, came out of the service. And when we were both out, we got together again and we traveled up through Canada. Got in my car back then, a 67 Camaro, which I just dearly loved, wish I had to this day. And we traveled all the way up the coast from Oregon and all the way across to Canada through the Rockies there to Calgary and then back down and had a wonderful trip, camped along the way. When we got home, we went to college together. We got an apartment together, slept in the same room, shared with somebody else. After the first year of college, when I was beginning to question what in the world I was doing and decided I just needed some time to sort my life and see, make sure what I was doing was important, and went down to New Mexico and went to work, and I called him up and got him a job with me, and we lived in the same trailer on a ranch in New Mexico, worked at a smelter in construction, got him his job, which became his career field and his expertise. When he got married, I was his best man. Now, I suppose that's pretty good friends. Pretty close, did a lot of things. When I started to attend church and began to change my life, he could no longer see the value of the friendship that we had maintained. When I would no longer go out drinking with him, or running, or doing whatever we used to do, he no longer felt that our friendship had particular value. So as I left for college, we never really had contact again. I'd see his mother for time to time when I'd go back to see my mother, since they all lived in Medford, and I at least knew where he was. I went through Green River, Wyoming, and I was going to look him up. Pulled out the phone book, wasn't in the phone book. Checked around the businesses, and there wasn't any that had his name on it. Called the operator, and she said, his number is unlisted. I says, can't you please, this was New Year's Day, I felt the chance was pretty high he'd be home. I said, can't you please give me a hint, some way I can reach him. I went and asked a few different people in shops and stores, have you ever heard of this man, this name? Nobody ever heard of him. And in discouragement, I slowly got in my car and drove out of town. I got out of town just a short distance, and I said, I've got to find him. I just want to say hi. I went back, turned around, crossed the median when nobody was looking. Went back into town. Stopped and thought. I called home to Michelle. I said, you know, maybe I've got the number, the address from years ago from his mom. Michelle wasn't home. Answered phone with my kids on it. Thought a little while. I thought, you know, he had a brother. He had a brother in Medford, Oregon. Maybe his brother's still around. So I called director assistance, and I asked for the name, and the man was there, and I got the number, and I called him, and he was home. And he told me what the address was, and I was excited. I drove up to the house, and I walked up to the door, and his wife came to the door and recognized me and let me in and gave me a big hug, and he was asleep on the couch, and she kind of woke him up, and he sat up, and he just kind of stared at me. And he figured out who I was, but he just kind of stared at me. This at one time, my best friend for years, in many, many situations, in good times and bad. I backed him up when he'd get in a fight, keep someone off his back as kids, and all the things that we went through, all the things that you go through. And the whole visit, the whole time I was there, there was never one time a mention of, boy, it's good to see you. Man, I'm glad to see you after all these years. Thanks for looking me up. Maybe the warmest thing that he said as we sat there and discussed was, sure is strange to see you after all these years. That was about the warmest comment that he made. We talked and chatted, and he told me about where the old boys were and the girls and where the friends had gone, and I thanked him. And I walked out the door, and I left. I know, brethren, where my refuge is. My refuge is with God and among its people. And among his people, and my refuge is in doing this work. And I am constantly reminded by circumstances in my life that some of the things that I set up and put together and some of the things that I valued and some of the things I did really wasn't where God was working after all. I can walk into this congregation with people that I have never met in my life, and there will be greater warmth and greater bonding and quicker friendships than with someone that I spent half of my life with growing up, at times risking each other's lives as well. And I can walk in the door here today, and I can walk out, and there will be more warmth than I experienced in that way. Now, that doesn't happen to everyone in every way, but it was a reminder. It was a reminder to me. The most important thing that I have in this life, brethren, is my calling. It is the most important thing I have. Now, my family is pretty important to me. And I'm about to experience just how important they really are, because I'm not on an expedition where I can turn around and then go home when it's over. I am here for the duration, and they're going to have to come to me. And so I'm about to experience just how important they really are, because I'm not going to turn around and just go back. But there's nothing that I have in this life that is more important than my calling. The home that I am aiming toward and ultimately focused on is my home in the kingdom of God. I've been called to be a part of the family of God, and nothing could possibly ever be more important than that? Matthew 13, just over, very small amount. Matthew 13 and verse 44. I don't even know when we started. What time did we start today? Anybody? Two? All right. I guess I'm not out of time yet, right? I don't even know where we are. I didn't look up. I was tinkering with my notes, and we kept driving left and right and up and down, and I said, man, I couldn't find this place again, but I will. I'll come back. Matthew 13 and verse 44, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, the family of God, the house of God ultimately is like treasure hidden in a field which a man found and hid, and for joy over it he goes and sells all that he has and buys the field. The kingdom of God is something that you would give up everything you've got, all of your treasures, all of your possessions, all of your own personal values for, and you would trade it gladly if you saw the value of it. And when we are called, that's what God does. He begins to open our mind to see what He has to offer to us. And I'm reminded constantly that it is worth so much more than anything else that I have ever had or put together on my own. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. When he had found a pearl that was more valuable than anything on the market, he sold everything he had. You know, there's a buffalo head hangs over my room, too. Like father, like son. I don't know what we're going to do. It takes a big house to hang that. It's a shoulder mount buffalo head, and it's the centerpiece for our front room. It is probably, in a foolish way, one of the greatest treasures I have on this earth. I don't know how to explain that to you. I love buffaloes. I think they're kind of majestic for in a cow sort of way. I looked for a head for years and finally acquired one from a rancher that thought that tourists in Nebraska wanted to buy those things. He was mistaken. But it's not worth that much compared to what God has offered in any way, shape, or respect. The kingdom of God is like a pearl or a treasure in which you'd take and you would give up every single thing, everything you treasured and valued, and you would do it in a second if you could just obtain indeed that kingdom and you knew indeed that's what it was for. One of the last things I did in Lubbock was to ordain a deacon in the Amarillo congregation. I did it during my sermon. I've never done that before, but my last sermon there was kind of like this first sermon. It was continuous, but maybe a little more fractured. There were things I wanted to say. There were last-minute issues I wanted to clear up. There were things I wanted to address. And so I kind of packaged them all together. And I was leaving, and you know, when you leave and walk out of an area, someone maybe is ready and needs to be ordained, but the clock kind of resets itself when the new minister comes in, because he can't go out and say, fine, who wants to be ordained? Raise your hand, you know. Lay the hands and off we go. So there was an individual. Amarillo didn't have a deacon, and I wanted there to be one. And there was a man, an individual, that the congregation had recommended. I told the people there that I would not ordain anyone that they themselves had not recommended. It had to be someone that they could say, yes, that man represents us. Or that woman, if it would have been a deaconess. And so I spoke to the congregation, and I gave them opportunity privately to make recommendation as to who they would put forth and who they looked to and who they respected. And it was the same individual that I was looking to already. There was a confirmation that at least who I and the other elders that were there were looking to, the congregation agreed. And so we went ahead and ordained him there as a deacon. And when I looked at the scriptures in 1 Timothy 3 and I began to read them to the congregation and I began to explain what God's instructions were here. It's an interesting thing in 1 Timothy 3. If you're not thinking about ordination, or if there isn't an ordination that has taken place, these are scriptures that in and of yourself you might not necessarily study as often as something else. But notice these scriptures and notice how they apply to the house of God. Not just to various positions of leadership and service in the house of God, but to all of the house of God. 1 Timothy 3, verse 1. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, I'm using the New King James. I was using the NIV years ago until the congregation threatened me with tomatoes. I said, all right. I used the New King James. Bishop here, it says literally overseer. It's what we would call an elder in the church. He desires a good work. So it actually says that it's not wrong to desire to have opportunity for special service. There's a long ways of difference that between desiring an opportunity for service and actually setting up a means to acquire that. I'm just saying it's good to want to serve God's people. A bishop, then, must be blameless, husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, apt to teach, not given to wine, not violent or greedy for money, gentle, not quarrelsome nor covetous, one who rules his house well, has his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man doesn't know how to rule his own house, how in the world is he going to take care of the church of God? What it says. My version. I apologize. From time to time I add words to the Bible, and I'm trusting that you're reading yours and you'll know what I've added and what the Bible said. That's just, I guess, the way sometimes I read it as I speak. Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. In other words, the passage is saying in terms of the elder, the overseer, that he really needs to be a successful individual as a Christian. Now, what in this category, with the exception of apt to teach, because that's a designation that is added in this category, but aside from that, what is it that you are not all required to do yourselves? Anybody here that doesn't have to rule his house well, doesn't have to be gentle, doesn't have to be not quarrelsome, doesn't have to avoid being covetous? There isn't anything in here, with the exception of apt to teach, that every single Christian in the house of God isn't required to do as well. Now you go on down to the deacon. Likewise, just like the elders, likewise the deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money. You go through and start comparing note for note, and you're going to find that essentially the deacons' qualifications are the same as the elders' qualifications, with the exception apt to teach. And Titus bears that out. It's worded differently. It's a little different. And so the deacon has pretty high qualifications here, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let these also be first proved, and then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and a great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. Now again, you have to ask yourself the same thing. What is there in the deacon's qualification that doesn't apply to us all? All Paul is saying is, if you're going to ordain somebody in the house of God, make sure they are successful at being a Christian. Don't ordain somebody that fails as a Christian. Now the fact is, every one of us, to be successful, must do all of these things, with the exception of apt to teach. Apt to teach is a blessing, it's a gift, but it's not a qualification of everyone in the congregation. But with that exception, this is simply Paul telling Timothy what the qualification of a Christian is. And then those who are successful Christians, we look to them as our leaders. And those who would be able to pastor or care or serve us in a special capacity. And that's all he's really saying. Verse 14, these things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I'm delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God. I'm telling you these things so you know how to act. How you know to act in the church. How you know how to function in the church. Not just the deacon or the elder, how the congregation knows. How Timothy would understand in terms of his own personal responsibility to pastor. It says, the house of God is the church of the living God, the pillar and the ground of all truth. And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. And then he goes on and he talks about what the gospel message is. God was manifested in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, believed on in the world, and received up to glory. So it's a message in that sense in that portion of the gospel. And it's just laid out here in that way. Now it's interesting. There's a difference between the message of the gospel and the messengers. The message of the gospel talks about the hope of salvation and the promise of the resurrection and the setting up of the kingdom. The messengers are the ones who have to qualify as successful Christians. Now the act then is, the intention is, the context is, as he tells Timothy, if you're going to preach the gospel, then let's be successful first as Christians, and here are the qualifications. And then those who are successful the most, let's let them be our leaders, and then we'll go preach the gospel. That's what he's saying. It's all in one chapter. Our job is to be these kind of messengers so that the message of the gospel then can truly go out. The message of the gospel is not so much flee from the wrath to come as it is that God is going to give us rest. How many people, as the first booklet they ever read 1975 in prophecy? Anybody? Say some. Me too. First book I ever read. Scared me. Scared the daylights out of me. And I was ready to be a Christian. Well, not really. Just scared me. Because I went home and went through that first year of college in Oregon and basically continued in the same lifestyle that I had before it scared the daylights out of me. But I just went through it a little more scared. But in time, because I understood and began to understand and God began to get my attention, it's amazing the lifestyle began to follow and the changes came as well. And I began to look at the passages in a place like here in Timothy about what the conduct of a Christian should be, and I began to strive to emulate that too. You know, I don't think it's necessarily wrong to have a hook. God uses hooks all the time. God's done some things to me to get my attention that I just couldn't hardly believe. But ultimately, we have to go beyond the hook to the reality of what this life is all about. This congregation is all of our congregation. As I understand, you're gifted as a congregation. There's a lot of leadership. There's a lot of special music. There's gifts and abilities here. I love that. I absolutely thrive on that, and I appreciate that, because I do believe there's a work to do, and I want to be about doing it, and this is my home. This is now my home. My spiritual home is in this body and in the congregations and where I serve and in the people here who have committed themselves to God. And I believe, indeed, if we will be the kind of messengers that God has called us to be, and if we will take it upon ourselves as responsibility to be accountable to God for everything, for the things that we think, for the things that we say, for the things that we do. You know, when I thought of visiting Johnny Fork, and that first thought came to my mind was just give him a good old punch and square the deck. And you know, the Holy Spirit in your mind says, come on, you can't do that. That's not right. And you go, yeah, okay. I'll take him to lunch. I'll put cyanide on his salad. No. But the Holy Spirit would have us indeed to be godlike. And so even when something like that comes to mind, we're still accountable because we make choices. We are still, brethren, choosing from the two trees. Every day. Every day we go out, we make a choice. We choose whether to say this or not, to think this or not, to do this or not, and we become accountable. And so Timothy here is being taught by Paul that, look, first you prepare the messengers, and then those messengers, they'll go out and they'll carry the message. And the message will have a much greater impact when the messengers are indeed successful at this Christian life and truly looking to and depending on each other and on God. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be back in the Northwest. Happy to be where I can have access to some of my other family, my physical family that I am close to as well. I'm very proud of my wife. This was actually a transfer of rather short duration. I've had a week and a half from start to finish. And this is finish. I'm here. My wife And I tell this story because I was so pleased with her. I was talking to one of the men from church administration on the phone, and he said, "Well, how soon could you leave?" And my wife said, "Well, you want me to pack his bags now?" She meant it. We had a great setup, great church. I love the people. I love Texas. I love the culture of Texas. There's a politeness down there. The yes, ma'am is a part of the culture. The getting the door and the politeness of the speech. I love the howdy and the y'all. It was pleasant. I liked the culture. But I was so proud of my wife when she said, "Well, do you want me to pack his bags?" And so I'm here. They'll be here as soon as they can follow. She's going to finish the packing. I called back and mentioned something in my files, and she said, "Too late." She had that all packed and in the garage as well, so it's moving out as quickly as she can get her hands on it. And the house is listed on the market, and as quickly as it sells, she'll be up here. And I, you know what I suppose? I think even if it doesn't sell quickly, I got the impression she's going to be up here. Because it doesn't take a lot of not being able to tuck your kids into their beds, not being able to say goodnight to your wife to decide that the house will just be sold when it's sold, and I'm sure we'll be setting up as quickly as we can. So I just want to send everyone greetings from us to you, and I look forward to your friendship and opportunities we'll have here to serve together, and it's nice now to be in Spokane.